It's time for Forward Nation Radio. Now here he is, the host of Forward Nation Radio, David Leventhal.
Welcome to Forward Nation Radio, March 8th, 2017, International Women's Day. Happy Women's Day to all. Then I should say, Privyet. Sorry for that lousy pronunciation for any Russian-speaking listeners. And I assume, since this is America, there are plenty of people from Russia listening in right now. We'd like to start a little bit talking about the news, and the number one story is Russia. Of course, you've heard a lot about this. There are several aspects, I believe, to the story on Russia that we've been hearing. The first question, of course, is, did Russia influence the U.S. election and help throw it to Donald Trump? And on this question, the information seems to be at least pretty well settled, that Russia did put its thumb on the scales, so to speak. We have a lot of information about Russian trolls. The internet is obviously full of Russian trolls, and we've seen all that. The U.S. intelligence agencies, while they're not infallible, they are unanimous in believing that Russia was a party to hacking emails and releasing that information through WikiLeaks and on their own. Okay, so Russia helped influence the election. Why would Russia influence the election? Well, that's the big second question that we all need to worry about over the next who knows how long. Obviously, one answer, the more charitable answer, is Russia influenced the election because Russia is a rival to the United States, and by making Donald Trump the president of the United States, Russia is clearly weakening the United States. It makes sense that Russia would want America to elect a president who was going to reduce our influence around the world. That only benefits Russia. What we need to consider, of course, and are forced to consider, is the possibility that there is a less charitable explanation for why Russia influenced the election. And the information as to whether or not Trump is being blackmailed or otherwise Russia is able to extort the President of the United States, and we are to some extent living under President Vladimir Putin, that I believe at this point is still an open question. We don't know about Donald Trump's sexual escapades or his business escapades. It is certainly time to release his taxes. The next question, of course, that we need to address with the Russia scenario in our election is the issue of investigating and investigations and finding out about Russia's role. Republicans have signaled their position on investigating. Rand Paul came out specifically and said, there's no value in Republicans investigating Republicans, thus shunting to the side the idea that Republicans in Congress might actually have a role toward or an obligation to the people, a role in promoting a more honest government and a better society, making it pretty clear what their naked intentions are. And those intentions were made clear by other Republicans as well. This is kind of akin to a few years ago when the idiots on Fox News read Republican talking points. Not just read Republican talking points, it's Fox News, so of course they're always reading Republican talking points, but they actually read the fact that they were reading Republican talking points. They read the memo that said, we are about to read Republican talking points. You're not supposed to give away that game. I expect that Rand Paul was spoken to by many of the people in his party who say, look, we're not about investigating, we're not about doing what's right for the country, we're about promoting the interests of our political party. But we're not about telling people that. The idea is you don't tell people that we don't particularly care about investigating anything other than what benefits Republicans. But there we are. This is not anything new. Republicans have a long history of abusing the investigative authority of Congress. Most recently, of course, in Benghazi, with the Benghazi investigation, where four U.S. Foreign Service officials, including the ambassador to Libya, were killed in Benghazi. And the Republicans spent years knowing that they were running against Hillary Clinton for president, that they spent years investigating this issue. In fact, spent more time, Congress invested more resources in investigating in Benghazi than they did investigating the top six most effective terrorist incidents against the United States, aside from 9/11, combined. Clearly, the interest was not to get to the bottom of what happened in Benghazi. There was no expectation that the Secretary of State interjected herself and led to the death of a U.S. ambassador and others. But they were rewarded by actually winning an election, so to speak. Their attacks on Hillary Clinton through false investigations actually worked. They have a long history of that. They've been investigating the Clintons since before the Clintons were first in the White House, before Bill was the President of the United States. They were investigating Bill Clinton for his sex life. There was an independent prosecutor basically living in the West Wing for the entirety of the Clinton administration. Oh, to yearn back to the days when the biggest concern on anyone's mind is the president's role in a $20,000 land deal on which he lost money. Whitewater. Conflicts of interest in the current administration make that really look like petty fare. Then, of course, we go back to 9/11 itself and the Republicans' role in investigating 9/11, or lack thereof. President Boy George and Vice President Darth Vader refused to testify about 9/11. Oh, don't tell Rudy Giuliani. I wasn't supposed to say that. Don't tell Rudy Giuliani that Boy George was president on 9/11. It'll break his heart. The President of the United States at that point refused to testify after 9/11, the number one terrorist incident in history. In fact, it took a long time and outrage by 9/11 victims' families to finally put enough pressure on the White House that the President of the United States was forced to finally give some testimony about 9/11. Now, this isn't right-wing radio. We're not going to advance conspiracy theories. I do not believe that Bush was behind 9/11, in part because 9/11 worked. And if George Bush had been behind it, the odds of it actually succeeding are slim and none. However, there were plenty of things to investigate regarding 9/11. Richard Clark, the head anti-terrorist in the American government at the time, wrote a book subsequent to 9/11 where he pointed out that the Clinton administration told the incoming Bush administration that they would be focusing most of their priority on Al-Qaeda, because that was such a tremendous threat to the United States. Instead, he writes, the Bush Justice Department, led by a religious fanatic, a former senator who was available to be Attorney General of the United States because he had just lost his Senate re-election bid to a dead man, John Ashcroft, instead focused on things like pornography, which was more of an issue of the religious right. This is obviously something that deserved to be investigated, in part to help us protect ourselves in the future. Well, finally, after much reluctance and many weeks, Bush finally relented and agreed that he would testify. But only if he did not testify under oath, and only if he testified together with Vice President Dick Cheney while sitting on his lap. All right, that last part I made up. Just the sitting on the lap part. Everything else in there is true. So obviously the Republicans have a long history of not investigating anything that might be uncomfortable to them and investigating anything that might be uncomfortable to the other side. Well, what else was in the news over the last week or so since we started? Well, when we went to press last week, the press was all a Twitter, no pun intended. The so-called liberal media was all a Twitter about the fact that the President of the United States had put on his grown-up pants and actually given a speech, which he was able to read from a teleprompter like a big boy and deliver without gratuitous comments, insults, or huge mistakes or picking a fight with anybody. Talk about setting the bar low. This is setting the bar at the bottom of a coal mine. Yes, everybody, Donald Trump has finally become presidential. He can read. This is setting a bar so low that it can be met by my 5-year-old son, Brennan. named after a Supreme Court justice and liberal icon, who also can read, but who, based on recent Twitter posts, actually probably spells better than our man-child in chief. Well, the euphoria over Mr. Big Boy Pants didn't last very long. And the Wizard of Id came back within a couple of days by posting a tweet attacking his predecessor, Barack Obama, for wiretapping President Trump. The basis of his claim? Right-wing propaganda radio. That's understandable, because where else could the President of the United States get information regarding the wiretapping of a U.S. citizen? Obviously, you're pretty much left with nothing other than going to right-wing radio. There's not a whole lot to talk about here, so I'm not going to talk about the charges, which were so baseless that it led the FBI director to actually come out publicly and say to the Justice Department, please do not take the President of the United States seriously. Do not treat this man as if he is a grown-up. But there are some other aspects to Trump's tweet on Obama's alleged wiretapping that are worth a little bit of a mention. First of all, he talked about our sacred democracy. I haven't heard commentary on the fact of the use of the word sacred and the appropriateness or inappropriateness of using a religious term, well, the use of a religious term by the President of the United States. Okay, maybe that's not a big one. But how about referring to our sacred democracy? The irony is really rich on this one, because this is something being done by a President of the United States who lost by 3 million votes. If Donald Trump believes in the sacredness of democracy, I invite him to step down. He'd have to take a lot of people with him, of course, but we really want to talk about democracy. We will come back to the issue of the U.S. pseudo-democracy in a future show very shortly. One other good thing that that tweet did, among other news during the week, is it reminded some of us of the existence of the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution. I know you know that one, but for the couple of you out there who may not know that, the 25th Amendment provides for the replacement of the United States President on the basis of disability. We talk about whether the Republican Congress could finally be moved to impeach this guy, but it's starting to look, in many respects, depending on what happens to any investigation that's finally forced upon them regarding the Russian issue. But it's other than that, it's looking more likely that the president might be removed under the 25th Amendment. Because already, in just a few weeks in office, his sanity is seriously in question. Certainly his integrity, though I'm not sure that that qualifies as a disability under the 25th Amendment. It's a pipe dream, however, because like impeachment, the 25th Amendment would have to be invoked by Republican leadership. And the Republican leadership obviously isn't going to invoke the 25th Amendment. In part because if we started removing people for disability, certainly for mental disability, we'd probably have to remove pretty much every Republican congressman and senator. You don't figure we're going to start that. Well, all this exciting news, the titillating news that was covered extensively by our media, has forced off the front pages some other news that might be more informative for our listeners and might matter more to the future of this country. One of them that I'd like to talk about for just a moment or two is the Trump budget outline and its slashing of IRS funding. That's right. Among the government programs that Donald Trump plans on slashing is funding for the IRS. Well, most of us may not be big fans of the IRS. I guess those of you who've been audited by the IRS, I expect to have plenty of at least mixed feelings about the IRS. But his call to reduce funding for the IRS as a way to help balance the U.S. budget and pay for his trillions of dollars in tax cuts, primarily for the wealthiest 1%, and his hugely stepped up military spending of over $50 billion a year, is the fact that the IRS is actually a moneymaker for the United States government. Every IRS agent we hire is actually a net gain. They bring in more money by collecting taxes that were not paid, that should have been paid, than they cost the U.S. government. So when you talk about slashing IRS agents in order to balance the budget, you're being disingenuous at best. By slashing IRS funding, you will in fact be worsening the federal budget deficit, and worse than that, you will be promoting tax cheating. You will be allowing tax cheaters to cheat that much more on their taxes. Even Trump's new Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, came out publicly against the Trump proposal to slash IRS funding. Anybody want to raise their hand if they think that that's going to make a difference? Obviously, Republicans, who have always been after slashing IRS funding, have made it perfectly clear why they want to slash IRS funding. It's because the tax cheaters who will now be able to walk free are primarily the Republican base, the Republican voters. This puts me in mind, again, of the Boy George administration. When it came out that the IRS, which had been defunded and IRS enforcement agents had been laid off, those that were left were putting a focus not on wealthy people who might be cheating on their taxes, but on poor people who might be cheating on their taxes, particularly those who were so poor that they qualified for the earned income tax credit. That was a policy that was changed early on in the Obama administration when he redirected IRS resources to go after wealthy people. This is the true nature of the battle of the IRS, whether wealthy people are going to be able to keep stealing from the country. Thanks to Trump's budget outline, it's going to be heady days for wealthy tax cheats. Also in the news, just coming in, breaking news, the Republican health care proposal. Yes, they finally come up with a proposal to replace Obamacare. Oops. Never mind. It looks like the Republican health care proposal is dead on arrival. Not because of Democratic opposition, but because of internal Republican opposition. We will discuss healthcare at a later date when the Republican proposal is finalized and we can analyze it more fully. But already we've seen a couple of things that should be troubling to most of us. One is the biggest problem that Republicans had with Obamacare, which of course was a Republican healthcare plan to begin with. The biggest problem that Republicans had with that plan was that it gave too many resources to poor people and middle-class people, and it didn't give enough to the rich. So we've already seen in the outline of the new plan that the Republicans will shift resources from helping poor people buy insurance to letting the American taxpayer pay for wealthy people who are already paying for their own insurance. Didn't see that one coming. One other thing, though, that we should be happy to see with the Republican health care proposal is finally someone has had the decency and the bravery to stand up against the evil of Planned Parenthood. That's right, everybody. Republicans are following through on their threat to destroy Planned Parenthood, a particularly worthy thing to talk about on International Women's Day. That's right. What the Republican health care plan will end up doing, and I think it's a pretty safe bet that whatever they end up with will do this, what the Republican plan will certainly end up doing is making it more difficult for women to make good healthcare, to make good reproductive choices, and men too, by the way. And it will increase the number of abortions that women get, despite Republicans professing to be against abortion. More on healthcare soon, but like everything else, there's nothing to be optimistic about. Finally, in the last piece of news, here's a fun piece of news before we go, and this will lead into the main subject of our discussion today. The Des Moines Water Authority in Iowa brought an action against a public utility for, it turns out, putting unacceptable level of nitrates into the drinking water of the citizens of Des Moines, Iowa. They brought a federal lawsuit, did the Water Authority, against that public utility. This, of course, puts many of us in mind of Flint, Michigan, where people in Flint, Michigan were exposed to lead in their water because of decisions made by the Water Authority and by a federal by a state overseer. Well, upset by the possibility that people in Iowa might have their health threatened by nitrates in the water, by unhealthy water, the Republican state legislature has rallied to the rescue. Not of the people, but of the public utility, by passing a bill to disband the Water Authority and replace it with a different Water Authority, which would presumably drop the lawsuit. This effort is apparently facing huge opposition, but it doesn't matter. It's going through anyway. Okay, I'd like to switch gears a little bit now and talk about ethics. I think the concept of ethics and what derives from our understanding of ethics and their role in society explains a lot of what's going on in our society right now. And I think understanding how ethics works and our ability to enforce ethics and why we might want to do so will give a lot of context to a lot of what we're reading and a lot of what we're going to be discussing. So I'm going to spend probably the rest of the program talking about ethics. First, of course, what are ethics? Ethics are basically the rules of the game, the rules of the community. Ethics are how community will prompt individuals within that community to act not for the benefit of themselves, but for the benefit of the community at large. Why? Because we're all better off if we don't act selfishly and instead act for a greater good. With due apologies to Ayn Rand, who is a big favorite of Speaker of the House Jim Rat, pretty much all of us agree that people do have a responsibility to act not selfishly, but for the benefit of others. That's why we're supposed to return a wallet that we find, not take the money out. We're not supposed to cut lines. We're supposed to hold doors open for people, help little old ladies across the street, not harm people beyond anything that we may have to do without being able to stop it. Where do we get our ethics? Who enforces them? Ethics come from our community. There are several different theories to explain where we might come up with our rules for our society. We're not going to go into that right now. That's beyond the scope of this discussion. But we look to our community to enforce its ethics. When the community is sufficiently certain that they want everybody to behave in a certain way, and when the community is large enough, such as, for instance, the entirety of New York City as a community believes that we should not be discriminating against people based upon sexual orientation, we pass a law. We pass a law that can be enforced. But in other cases, we don't enforce ethics through laws. They're enforced, if they are at all, through our community. for those of us who were forced to read the Scarlet Letter in school. We might think back to Hester Prynne having to wear the letter A on her breast wherever she went in the community. This was a way to tell her and everybody else in the community, you do not violate the community's norms. That way you get people acting in a way that benefits the community and benefits everybody at large and not just themselves. The problem, of course, is that it's frequently difficult to enforce ethics. The changing nature of one's community is a threat to our enforcement of ethics. We do not live in communities that tend to be as insular as that in which Hester Prynne lived centuries ago. Those of us who read that story now look back and think that's a little quaint. That's awful, but why didn't she just move? Why didn't she just move somewhere else and then take the Scarlet Letter off and live a normal life? The fact that we can move from community to community and our communities are not so isolated makes it more difficult to enforce our ethics. Why does this matter? If you don't enforce ethics, the ethics fall apart. Once people start violating the rules, you create a race to the bottom. You've experienced that when you've been waiting for a municipal bus, perhaps, and one person cuts the line. If the community, in this case those people on the line, don't immediately rebuke that person, what happens next? Other people start joining in. Hell, if this person's cheating and getting away with it, benefiting himself, then why don't I? Many of us have been in traffic on the Long Island Expressway when one jackass has passed us on the right on the shoulder, driven around five or six cars on the shoulder, cut back in, made traffic actually worse for everybody, but benefited him or herself by five or six cars, maybe a few seconds worth of time. Inevitably, when you see the first car do that, what happens next? You see other people follow. You create this race to the bottom. Because in an ethical world, it is the unethical person who wins. In a world in which everybody returns a wallet that they find, the one person who chooses not to return a wallet has it perfect on all ends. If he loses a wallet, he gets it back. If he finds a wallet, he gets to keep it. So the whole system's going to break down unless they can be enforced. That's why people feel guilt. That's why I argue much of the reason why we have religion. I think we created religion, society created religion in part to let people believe that there will be a price to pay at some point. For those people for whom guilt is not enough to change their behavior. I don't take money out of the wallet because it's not worth it. The $20 I get from the wallet will lead to such guilt that I don't want to take the money out of the wallet. It's just not worth it to me. So I act ethically, I leave the money in the wallet, I return the wallet as is. For those people who have less guilt, there are going to have to be other ways to enforce ethics. Religion is one way to do that. When you look around at society and you see, especially now, during the Trump administration, when you have the ascendancy of truly the lowest life forms on the planet, you think, why be ethical? Why be decent? Everybody else is cheating and getting away with it. Everybody else is lying and getting away with it. Why don't I? Well, it looks like they're getting away with it. But trust me, there will be a price to pay at some point. Not necessarily in this life, but in the next one. This is a way to scare people enough into thinking that acting ethically would be a good idea. Because will we do the right thing? Will we do the community-minded thing when it is in our personal interest to do the community-minded thing? Of course we will. Osama bin Laden would have acted ethically if it was in his best interest to act ethically. If we can make more consistent, harmonize our personal well-being with the community well-being, we will all be ethical. Well, that's with human beings. What about businesses, corporations, which comprise the bulk of the U.S. economy? And let's face it, have a huge impact on the way we behave and an impact on the way our society conducts itself. Are businesses asked to be ethical? Are businesses being ethical? Some of you might be familiar with the famous or infamous Ford Pinto case, where Ford was making a car called the Pinto that was made with a slight defect. This was in the 1970s, so I'm going back a long way. But it's still in business textbooks. Ford made this car in the 1970s with this defect. A small defect meant that the car tended to burst into flames when it was bumped from the rear. So when Grandma, driving her Ford Pinto, stopped at a red light and the person behind her wasn't paying attention, I wanted to say it was texting, but this is the 1970s, we weren't texting. The person behind wasn't paying enough attention and bumped Grandma from the rear. Grandma's car tended to blow up. Ford knew about this problem and chose not to fix it. The problem could have been fixed, in fact, with a part that cost $11. Obviously, the expense to Ford would have been more than that, because they would have had to recall the cars and replace them. But it was $11 piece that would have fixed the car. And instead, they decided that they were better off selling the car as it was. There are other examples. Roger and Me, Michael Moore's first movie, a funny and interesting movie, tells the story of General Motors and what happens when a company like General Motors picks up and closes a factory employing thousands of people, the extent to which that devastates the town. It was a funny movie. It was an interesting movie. It was a provocative movie. And it was illustrative of how General Motors has been acting then and since then, where they move to a town, they extract concessions in order to stay because of the threat of leaving, because of how much that will harm the town. But then ultimately, when it becomes time to pick up and leave, when they could make more money to leave, they pick up and leave. Lots of companies, we have lots of examples of companies like GM, like Ford, employing such a cost-benefit analysis. I can remember back to the first space shuttle disaster, the 1986 space shuttle Challenger disaster. Turns out, after the fact, we found out the company that made the defective part of the space shuttle knew about the problem. They weighed how expensive it was to replace it and start over, with the likelihood that there would be a catastrophic failure, and decided to go right ahead. Some of my listeners may even remember TWA Flight 800, which crashed off of Long Island, killing hundreds of people. Turns out, we found out after the fact, Boeing, the maker of the plane, knew about the defect that ultimately caused the plane to crash. Calculated how expensive it was going to be to fix it, and decided that it was more cost effective to leave it the way it was. The only thing that was really remarkable about the Ford Pinto case, as far as I'm concerned, the thing that makes it a real business textbook example of a lack of corporate ethics, is because of how little Ford Pinto valued Grandma. Turns out Ford had an internal memo that calculated that each person who was to get third-degree burns from the Pinto blowing up. And they calculated it would be about 180 people, I believe. That each person who would get third-degree burns would cost them about $67,000. Each death, about 180, would cost about three times that, about $200,000. Turns out, we felt that that was kind of undervaluing human lives. There are so many examples of a lack of corporate ethics. Oil companies leading the charge against climate change. Pharmaceutical companies, finance companies, I don't even have to say more, pharmaceutical companies and finance companies. Should we be shocked by this? Should we be asking for ethics from businesses? When I first started teaching, there was a story on the front page of the New York Times, a story about a company called Malden Mills, a textile company in Massachusetts. This was a third-generation family-owned company owned by a guy named Aaron Feuerstein. Malden Mills suffered a catastrophic fire and burned to the ground. Aaron Feuerstein was offered so much insurance money, he could have just walked away. No one in his family would ever have had to work again. He was offered the opportunity, as usually is the case, by other states who were looking to steal the business from Massachusetts, giving subsidies, tax abatements, probably free water, free electricity. That's what usually happens for them to go locate there. But he said no. He wasn't going to do that. The workers in Massachusetts had supported his family for three generations, and he felt he owed it to them. And he was ethical. So ethical it made the front page of the New York Times. So ethical it was a segment on 60 Minutes. So ethical that Aaron Feuerstein was invited to the State of the Union address being given by President Clinton at the time, and was given a shout out for his being ethical. And what a shining example he was of a more ethical world of ethics in business. And Feuerstein was later quoted as saying something to the effect of, boy, I sure got a lot of attention for that. That doesn't really speak well for our society. Recently, a Harvard Business School, or a pledge drive started at Harvard Business School, where business school students were signing a pledge saying that they were going to be ethical when they got out. They were going to be ethical in business. It spread to other schools. Why not look to these shining examples and ask for more ethics among corporations? Well, I don't think that corporations should be asked to be ethical. I think that's kind of an academic discussion because I think bottom line is they're generally not going to be ethical no matter what we ask of them. I don't think they should be ethical in part because ethics are not the province of companies. It's not Bill Gates to decide whether the behavior he's engaging in is appropriate or not appropriate. Our ethical decisions are sometimes difficult to come by. It's up to the people of the community. It's up to a broader society to decide whether Microsoft is acting in an ethical way, in an appropriate way. I think that it's easy once people get into the business world to rationalize their lack of ethical behavior. We look around us. Remember, ethics come from our community. And in the business world, we see people cutting corners, making compromises. When students are asked in business school, would you engage in the kind of behavior that has made the headlines? The answer is easy to say. No, of course not. I wouldn't be that unethical. But that's not the way that kind of step-by-step sacrifice of your ethics works. In fact, it works step-by-step. What happens is you don't get from point A to point Z overnight. You do it by a series of steps. It's one little compromise after another. And when you're going to find out that you are involved in a race to the bottom, where your business success is going to depend on your being willing to compromise your ethics, I don't care what promise these people have signed to business school, when they get out into the working world, they're going to start compromising on their ethics. What is the true lesson of Malden Mills? Well, Malden Mills was back on the front page of the New York Times just a few years later when it declared bankruptcy. Experts said that the company had to declare bankruptcy because of the ethical decisions that its owners had made. What is the lessons of Malden Mills? Don't be ethical in business. It's a step towards not becoming successful. The most ethical people during that race to the bottom will get weeded out along the way. You work your entire life, you study hard, you do well in college, you go to graduate school, you do real well, you finally get that entry-level job you wanted in for a big advertising agency, you work like a slave for years, and finally your ship comes in. And your boss comes up to you and says, you finally got your own account. Congratulations. You've got the Philip Morris account, and we'd like you to sell cigarettes to children. And you stand up and say, I'm sorry. I'm not going to sell cigarettes to children. That's not who I am. You can expect that that's the end of your business career. If it's not the end, it's certainly the end of your advancement. So for the most part, and I realize I'm overgeneralizing here, but I don't think I'm overgeneralizing a whole lot. If you've risen all the way up the corporate ladder, you've probably been someone who's been willing to make compromises all along the way. We've weeded out the most ethical people. That, I believe, is the true lesson of Malden Mills. We shouldn't expect corporate ethics, whether or not we should ask for it. So what is the result of the situation we have? Well, the example I gave regarding General Motors and how they pit state against state, municipality against municipality in a bidding war to keep the corporate factory, to keep the corporate business. Every municipality in America is subject to this, including New York City, which has spent billions of dollars over the last years paying it to businesses to prevent them from moving, including such poor businesses in need of funding as the New York Stock Exchange, the New York Yankees, NBC. What is the result of all this? When big businesses get to go and extort concessions from the towns and communities in which they operate, several things happen. First of all, the tax burden is shifted from corporations to individuals. Over the years, the share of corporate taxes to state tax revenues have been reduced by at least half. Well, how do states make up for this lost revenue? Well, one thing they do, of course, is they shift the tax burden from corporations to individuals. Individuals now have to pay the taxes that corporations aren't. Well, but the corporations have all the money and most of the individuals don't. And most of the wealthy individuals are avoiding their taxes anyway. So that's not going to cover the loss generally. You're going to see a loss in services. Public education costs go up. Government services go down. Water treatment goes down. They're going to have to make up revenues in other ways. Red light camera use increases. $1,000 speeding tickets start being seen around the country. If government can't raise the money honestly by taxing wealthy corporations, it's going to raise it dishonestly by using law enforcement to extort money out of human beings. When Michael Brown was executed by the police in Ferguson, Missouri a few years ago, the follow-up to that story was the extent to which the town of Ferguson, Missouri relied upon fines imposed upon its citizens to support the town's funding. This is outrageous. But this is what's happening when corporations don't pay their own taxes. What else happens from this? This part I really like. Every politician talks to you about how much they love small businesses. Small businesses are the engines of job growth and job creation in America. Every politician talks about how much they love small businesses. And yet, The result of this system is to kill small businesses. Small businesses are at a huge competitive disadvantage against big businesses because small businesses are not in a position to extort concessions from towns and municipalities. So if we don't like this result, and we can't like this result, how do we influence corporate behavior so that corporations act in ways that are not harmful to society, but in fact beneficial to society? Well, there's basically two ways. The first way is the conservative way, what I refer to as the market mechanism. Conservatives will tell you that businesses will act ethically, will act according to community values and promote community interests, because customers will refuse to buy their products if the corporations are behaving in ways that do not benefit the society at large. We don't have a lot of time left, so I'm really not going to spend a whole lot of time on this one. This is a non-starter. Ask yourself, do you refuse to conduct business with a particular corporation because of the way it conducts its business? Maybe you do. Maybe you've heard about some instance of corporate misconduct that has really bothered you. Maybe, like me, you won't buy a Volkswagen right now. Okay, do you do that with three or more companies? How about five or more? When I ask this question to my students in my class, I may get a couple of hands go up with one. When I ask three or more, as I did just earlier today, as a matter of fact, nobody's hand goes up. Clearly, we are not utilizing the market mechanism to change corporate behavior. Why not? I think there's all kinds of reasons why the market mechanism is not going to work in the real world. First of all, divide and conquer. Big size matters. I'm one individual. So what if I go shopping at Walmart because I need sweatpants and this is the most convenient? I'm only one person. What difference does that really make? The market mechanism really only works if people act in great numbers. And that's really hard to do. But the main reason, of course, that the market mechanism doesn't work is because you don't have the information that you need to make the kind of informed decisions where you could change behavior. I give that in class quiz where I give examples of 25, 30 recent examples of gross business misbehavior. Nobody recognizes which businesses were involved. The so-called liberal media isn't broadcasting business misconduct. Who is this so-called liberal media? Almost all the news the average American gets comes from one of six major media conglomerates, down from a whole lot more from years ago. Disney owns ABC. You think ABC News is going to run stories about Disney's misconduct? Of course not. But you might say, well, wait a minute, NBC would love to run a story about Disney's misconduct. But think about it. No, they don't. NBC doesn't want to start that kind of a war. If NBC starts running stories about Disney's misconduct, NBC, GE, Universal, whoever mostly owns them now, it's hard to keep track, they're going to start a fight amongst themselves. Better to just keep a truce. Don't advertise each other's misconduct. Take a look at the evening news. Or better yet, don't take a look at the evening news. There's no news on the evening news. ABC Evening News had been promoting its weatherman in its commercials. There's the news for you. You'll find out which woman threw a baby out of the window, but you won't find out which corporations are acting in ways that are harming society. The way we enforce free speech in this country, the amount of news that comes from corporations, not just those who own media, but those who advertise in media, those who are able to throw alternative facts out into the world, i.e. climate change, means that we are often more misinformed than we are informed. Finally, confidentiality agreements are routine in corporate America. Businesses require their customers frequently. Certainly those who have a complaint against the company. To not share negative stories about them. A recent story about businesses bringing actions for customers who put negative reviews up on the web. The problem with the Ford Pinto case was how little Ford Pinto valued the life of the people it harmed. How was it able to do that? Well, when someone blew up in a Ford Pinto, Ford had someone really sympathetic, really nice, a grandmotherly looking old lady, someone who was chosen for her job because of how empathetic she was, how she could sit with you and cry and hold you and hug you while she told you how much Ford cared for you. And all at the same time saying, we didn't do anything wrong, but Ford loves our customers and we want you to be better. All we need you to do is sign right here. And when you sign right here, one of the things that you're going to do will give you $10,000, $20,000 to help you pay for your medical bills. But with that comes the fact that you will promise never to tell anybody what happened to you. Confidentiality agreements, by their very nature, are an affront to a civilized democracy and a civilized company. I'm being told, by the way, that the current owner of NBC is Comcast, although I believe I read something that's a little more complicated than that, that GE still has some interest. They're looking to get more interest, and Universal, it was NBC Universal for a while. I think it may be a little more complicated, but anyway, it looks like Comcast is at least the main owner. But either way, it's a major corporation that has a tentacle on every aspect of our society. So the market mechanism doesn't work to change corporate behavior and make businesses act in ways that benefit society rather than harming it. What other means do we have? Well, the answer, and the reason I'm a liberal, is we have laws. We have the legal mechanism. We can pass laws, we can regulate. We can make it in a corporation's interests not to violate the law. A cruise ship company may not dump its human waste into the oceans, not because it has ethics, but because perhaps the likelihood of getting caught and the fine is so great that it's just not worth it. It's just not in its interests anymore to act in those ways, to do something that is harmful to society. Well, let's start talking about the Republican agenda. Because this basically explains the Republican agenda. What is it that can interfere with our ability to pass laws that would change corporate behavior and make it more consistent with the values and interests of the community at large? Well, the first thing that comes up is the issue of federalism, or states' rights. And that's about the distribution of power between the federal government and state governments. Federalism is frequently broached by Republicans, who say, well, we should be leaving things up to the states, not doing things at the federal level. We've already seen that with the Trump administration with environmental laws. Let's not use the EPA. Let's leave it up to the states. Federalism, in fact, the concept of states' rights, incorporating the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Well, unfortunately, what might have worked in the 18th century does not work in the 21st century. The fact that we are less insular than we were means that states frequently do not have the ability to regulate corporations. The example that I gave with GM and other companies that extort concessions from states by threatening to move. Well, that works for a whole lot of things. If you seek to regulate me, if you prevent me from polluting and therefore improving my profits, I will pick up and I will move to another state. How do you prevent this from happening? How do states prevent themselves from getting caught in this intergovernmental bidding war? The answer is we need federal laws. Beyond that, at some point, we're going to need international laws as well because businesses are now able to threaten to leave the country. But even with that, businesses who leave the country still need to sell in America, and we could still get back at them if they try to do that and give them a disincentive to move. But we need more federal laws. The only way that you can regulate corporations frequently is through federal laws. How do I know that the Republicans who are always calling for states' rights when it comes to economic issues, aren't really serious. They don't really believe in states' rights. Look at what the federal government is talking about right now. An issue of states' rights and ethics maybe means that the state of Colorado and the state of California should be able to decide that for their citizens, marijuana should be legal, shouldn't be punished. What do states' rights advocates in our federal government say about that? Well, we're thinking about actually using federal law to prevent California and Colorado and other states from doing what they want to do. That doesn't sound like people who believe in states' rights. During the Bush administration, the state of Oregon twice passed a ballot initiative allowing for physician-assisted suicide under very prescribed conditions. States' rights advocates in the Bush administration argued that they would arrest doctors who prescribed lethal combinations of medicine. There are legions of examples of where Republicans in Congress who argue states' rights to prevent the federal government, the only entity that can regulate corporations from regulating, don't really believe in states' rights. What this is really about is corporations' rights, because that's who really benefits from their unwillingness to pass federal laws. This explains our current attack on regulatory agencies and why Republicans are always so quick to starve federal agencies of money. It's called starve the beast being government, the government regulatory state. They have a name for it. That's right. Starve the beast means if you deny all these money, all these resources for federal agencies, they won't be able to regulate. The result, again, is we're all worse off in the long run. You will not change business behavior to make it more beneficial for society. You will, in fact, allow businesses, encourage businesses to act in ways that harm the rest of us while benefiting themselves. The way we gather info prevents regulatory agencies from doing their job. The fact that, going back to our discussion of Republican investigations, we won't be investigating because we don't want to know. Finally, the issue of tort reform, one of my favorites. Many of you out there who aren't aware of any business misconduct have heard of the famous McDonald's coffee case, the legend of McDonald's coffee. Woman spills hot coffee on herself. Oh my God. Sues McDonald's. Poor McDonald's. Look at all the money that that poor company's going to have to pay. Because this woman spilled coffee on herself. That's ridiculous. Well, it turns out that the story that you've been told about McDonald's coffee is basically bullshit. That in fact, the situation, what McDonald's did was far more egregious. But there's a reason that that legend is being spread. It's the same reason that emails go around. Some of you might have gotten this. That tell you in two sentences something that happened and then say, see, this is an example of how our legal system is run amok. Attack the legal system. And you can promote something called tort reform, where you give corporations immunity from lawsuits, either whole or in part. You reduce damages that jurors can award. And people support this with the idea that's been fed to them that corporations are the subject to blackmail from individuals, and oh, how hard it is to be a corporation. These stories are made up. We ran a program at my school several years ago where we invited the assistant head of the tort division of the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank, to come talk to us about the issue of tort reform. He was the first one to speak, and he told the McDonald's coffee case. And I looked out in the audience, and I could see the audience getting upset at the ridiculousness of this. I also looked on the panel where there were a couple of more liberal legal activists who knew the true story of the McDonald's coffee case and couldn't wait for their turn to correct all the misstatements that this man was making. And I could see the audience turn when they were shown the true facts, that it turns out it wasn't that bad. What is the theory of tort reform? The legal system can't be trusted. McDonald's is subject to these lawsuits that, oh, poor McDonald's. We have frivolous lawsuits. People are bringing lawsuits that have no basis. President Boy George signed a bill during his administration to limit punitive damages and said that will eliminate frivolous lawsuits, or at least reduce frivolous lawsuits. This was a ridiculous statement on its own because by its nature, punitive damages are not awarded in frivolous lawsuits. Punitive damages are only awarded in victorious lawsuits. There are frivolous lawsuits. They are designed to extort a few dollars out of a company or an individual who finds it not worthwhile to go to court. But the best example of why we need tort reform from the right is that people are too stupid to serve on juries. Juries can't be trusted to render a fair and impartial decision. Evidence doesn't seem to indicate that, actually. But more than that, I really find this argument interesting. Here's the way juries work. People are chosen to serve on a jury because they've demonstrated that they are unbiased and they could render an unbiased and thoughtful, honest opinion. They are forced to sit there and listen to both sides present their testimony for days, at least. They are listening to both sides. And there is a neutral arbiter, the judge, who prevents the introduction of information that could be prejudicial or mislead the jury into making a bad decision. If people are too stupid to serve on juries, I put it to you, we have deeper problems than changing our legal system. We need to change democracy. Because compare a juror to a voter. Are voters unbiased? Let's face it, most voters already know who they're going to vote for president in 2040. Whoever's running for the Democratic or Republican Party because they have one of those tattooed on their butts. Are people forced in a Democratic election to listen to both sides' arguments, to listen to a full discussion of all of the issues in play? Of course not. That's ridiculous. The average American is pretty uninformed. Is there a neutral arbiter to prevent voters from being confronted with misleading, prejudicial, biased information, alternative facts even? Obviously not. In fact, one would argue that that's pretty much the way the average voter makes his or her decision. That's almost the entirety of information that many of our voters have. If people are too stupid to serve on juries, people are sure as hell too stupid to vote. And I've been saying this for a long time, and obviously, in 2017, the evidence is in. Our legal system does need reform, but generally in the opposite direction. It's a corporation that spends millions of dollars on fancy lawyers that can bend the legal system to their own benefit. They're not being victimized by it. Erin Brockovich is an uplifting movie, but it's really not the best uplifting movie. It's not most representative. A different movie, A Civil Action, is far more representative of what happens more often in our justice system, where corporations use their money to pervert the legal system. Finally, just briefly, the last thing is something called arbitration clauses. Corporations have learned to get themselves out of the legal system by forcing people who do business with them to sign away their right to bring a lawsuit. This should be blanket illegal, but it's not, and it's growing. It is commonplace. You out there have signed away your right to sue. If you have a credit card, you've probably signed away your right to sue. It's right there. You should have noticed it on page 87, footnote 67C in the fine print. Get your magnifying glass out. Companies routinely using arbitration clauses, cell phone contracts, nursing homes. I bought a car last year. They tried to get me to sign an arbitration clause that I could not sue. The New York Times a year ago had a wonderful expose, a wonderful series on the misuse of arbitration clause and how they are harming our society. They're keeping people out of the courtroom. Oh, and you want to know the most fun part about arbitration clauses? The company gets to pick the arbiter. The company chooses the private judge. That's what arbitration is, by the way. They go in front of a private judge, not an actual court. And the company will choose the private judge. Well, now let's go back to what we've learned about business. You've decided that you want to open up an arbitration company and you want to be successful. Let's talk about what your business strategy is. Your business strategy is to side with the corporation. the party that's going to decide whether or not you're going to get hired. So you're going in front of a private judge who's hired and paid for by the company you're suing. This will lead to a further discussion later about campaign finance reform and how we need to change the way our politicians are elected. If politicians are not out there passing laws that benefit the American public, we're sunk. Well, that's Forward Nation Radio for the week. I thank you for joining us. I once again thank our entire crack team, our producer Damian Hardeen, Julia Adamo, our director of research, Carolyn Balcom, our graphic artist, Nicholas Brell, technology director, Rafi Cooper, our announcer Mario Brito, and our new staff member, who I have not yet met, Paula Volos, who will be in charge of something really important. Please, please join us on copy editor. Thank you. I'm reminded that she. Sorry, Paula, that she is our copy editor. Thanks to everybody. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to seeing you next week, and I look forward to seeing you on ForwardNationRadio.com, on Podbean, you know, all the usual places. Thank you very much. Have a good week.
You've been listening to Forward Nation Radio with David Leventhal.